Hello. 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 Hello.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everybody. And Halloween's right around the corner. I'm going to New Orleans with Jerry. I'm dressing up and I'm going to have a great time. Maybe I'll have a little bit of Halloween candy. Usually don't indulge, but I just might. But the question is, what are the worst Halloween candies for your teeth? And here to discuss this very deep topic is Dr. Hal Stewart. He's an experienced cosmetic dentist in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He lectures extensively across the country and the world, teaching people, including dentists, about advanced restorative and cosmetic dentistry. He's here with me somewhere tonight. Ben, is our doctor here? Aha! He's going to be getting us back on. But I guess I want to talk about Halloween candy. We're going to be talking about, I mean, are you more like a smarty pants kind of person? Are you more of a Jolly Rancher person? Or might you be more of a chocolate person? I think if I'm going to indulge in candy, it's going to be probably of the chocolate variety just because it's just chocolate. Do we have the dentist on? Do we have Dr. Stewart on? All right, here we go. All right, here we go. Hi, doctor. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Good, good. So you created this list. It's really fun. And I want to talk just briefly about, is sugar really that bad for your teeth? And what if you brush your teeth right after you have sugar?
Well, sugar is bad for your teeth, but it's bad for your whole body as well. So
yeah.
Brushing right afterwards, obviously, is the very best thing to do. You still have the sugar in your body, and that creates an acidic environment. But yes, I would highly recommend that kids or adults brush their teeth just as soon as possible after eating a sugary snack.
Of course, that's what you want to do right after you have a Hershey's bar. But
exactly.
Let's talk. I love your top 10, if you will, of the Halloween candy. Well, what is your first one? Let's talk about the first one you have on your list.
Well, anything that's sticky and gooey. It's going to be loaded with sugar. And if you have braces, which so many kids do, or maybe they have stainless steel crowns or, you know, apparatus in their mouth, that's the worst thing that they could be chewing and eating on because it's so easy to pull things off and pull wires and brackets, and that doesn't make the orthodontist very happy.
Oh, absolutely. So something like a Mary Jane or even a Starburst. I remember years back, someone hurt their mouth on a Starburst and brought a lawsuit, and I thought, God, don't you know when you eat a Starburst, it's probably going to yank something out of your mouth, maybe even your teeth?
Well, you have to also realize a lot of the candy that kids are going to be eating this Halloween were made about over a year ago. You know, sugar lasts forever. So the Starburst can get quite hard over that period of time and actually kind of turn into a jawbreaker, if you will.
Other than...
Which is my number two.
Yeah.
On the list.
Well, you know, in a jawbreaker...
Stay away from those.
It kind of, the name kind of speaks for itself as far as that goes.
Right. It's more like a toothbreaker, but yeah, a jawbreaker as well.
Now, you had Twix on the list, and I was kind of surprised to see Twix as a bad candy for your teeth. Why is that so bad?
Well, it's not necessarily singling out Twix, but just any kind of, you know, a lot of people think chocolate, milk chocolate is... That's safe to eat, and you know, while it's not going to necessarily pull brackets off or break teeth, it is loaded with sugar, and so it's just as bad from a standpoint of sugar in your mouth. So if you eat a Twix, brush as soon as you can.
Now, I have a question. I know that, you know, probably sugar substitutes are probably not the best for your health, and despite that, I drink my Diet Coke in the morning. But what about sugarless gum? Is there something wrong with chewing sugarless gum?
Not at all. There is a sugar substitute now that's actually very healthy for you. It's a naturally occurring. It's called xylitol with an X, X-Y-L-I-T-O-L, xylitol. And any candy with xylitol in it not only won't rot your teeth out, but it will create a more alkaline environment in your mouth, and it actually has an antibacterial effect for the bad bacteria in the mouth. So a lot of mission trips will take xylitol candies to the children in these third world countries, because toothbrush is only going to last so long, but maybe they can't take toothbrushes. But if they can get these kids to eat a couple of pieces of xylitol gum a day, it reduces the incidence of cavities by about 75%.
That's really fascinating.
All other things being equal. Yeah, so xylitol, look for that chemical. Okay. And it's naturally occurring. It's very safe. It's used in a lot of natural products.
Yeah.
And it's very good, too. It doesn't have that, that substitute sugary, that chemical taste to it.
Is that the one that kind of hurts your stomach, though, upsets your stomach a little bit, or is that something else?
Yeah, well, it's not any more than anything else. I think the stevia might be you might be talking about that. But okay. The xylitol is not, I mean, obviously if you eat 25 pieces of gum, it's probably going to upset your stomach. But in normal amounts, that hasn't really been a problem.
I want to go to some kind of general questions, dentistry questions. Would you mind taking some calls if we have some questions here?
Oh, yeah, not at all. I mean, sure. I'd love to.
If anybody has questions for Dr. Hal Stewart, he's a cosmetic dentist, give us a call here and we'll get you on and answer your questions. 312-981-7200. Okay, let's talk about brushing teeth. What is the best way to brush your teeth? Is it an electric toothbrush? If you don't have an electric toothbrush, should we do soft, medium, or hard?
Yes, electric toothbrush by far is the best, but there's a wide variety. Don't skimp on an electric toothbrush, because if you buy the top of the line, like the top of the line Sonicare, even Sonicare, like watches, they make different levels of quality. Get the highest quality toothbrush. It'll last a long time. Replace the toothbrush head once every 6 to 8 weeks and as directed. Yeah, the little heads you can purchase through your dentist, or you can purchase them online. But replace those every couple of months. That's key as well. But use them as directed, 2 minutes every time you brush. And most of them have timers on them. But the Waterpik, Sonicare, Oral-B, Braun, they all have excellent electric toothbrushes, and there's no comparison. It's like driving a Maserati and then going down to a Chevrolet when you go to a manual toothbrush. But if you have to use a manual toothbrush, you want to use one with very soft bristles on it and just a nice circular motion. Brushing up the gum line is the most important. That's where the plaque will accumulate. And then flossing is once a day. A good thorough flossing is all you need to do. You don't need to floss after every meal, just once a day, and then brush the right way twice a day. That's the minimum to do. And if you'll do it that way, that will eliminate probably 90% of the problems you'll have with cavities.
Before we take a break,
and gum disease.
Just quickly, what is the most common problem you see with the way people take care of their teeth? Is there something that you see all the time that you say, if you could just fix this, you would really take care of your teeth a lot better?
I would have them change their diet. That's the most important thing. People have such an acidic diet, and we take an acidity level in every patient that comes in through our hygiene program. At every appointment they come through, we take an acidity level of their mouth, and the vast majority of them have an acidity level that's below, or that's acidic. And an acidic pH is going to cause gum disease and tooth decay, because it promotes the bad kind of bacteria, the anaerobic bacterial growth.
So let's
that would be the number one thing.
That's interesting.
Diet.
Very, very. Well, and that sums up everything in life, for your health, right?
Yes.
Exercise
right,
is
exactly.
Important, but it's really what you put in your body, and so many
food
of us.
Food is the most potent drug we put in our body.
Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll take your calls about general dentistry, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're here with Dr. Hal Stewart, and it's the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. We're talking to Dr. Hal Stewart, who is an experienced cosmetic dentist in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He talks and lectures all over the world about this issue. Welcome back to the show, Doctor.
It's great to be here tonight. Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's go to Bob in Elmhurst. He has a question about his fillings falling out. Hi, Bob. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. You're talking to Dr. Hal Stewart.
Hey, Bob. Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're good.
Okay, great. I have three teeth whose fillings have, you know, deteriorated and pretty much fallen out. I can still feel that there's some filling in there, but I can't afford to get them recapped, and they're probably not able. One or two of them may have to be pulled. So my question is, two questions. One is there long-term health if I wait a year or two to have them recapped or have an implant put in? And then what are your thoughts if it's an in-between tooth in the back, that how do you feel about like a partial versus, let's say, implants if it can't be capped again?
Okay, Bob, I'm going to hang up now. Can you listen on your radio just because there's a little bit of interference here? Thanks for the call,
sure.
Bob. Go ahead, Doctor.
Very good questions, Bob. First, I'll address your first question. If you have teeth that have bacterial caries or decay in them, you want to get that taken care of immediately. It doesn't mean that you have to do a definitive long-term restoration in the tooth, but you need to at least address the decay, do the minimum you can to preserve the tooth, get the decay out, and then the tooth is there for you to then, when you can afford it or at a better time, then to have it recapped. If the teeth or the tooth is not worth saving, if you took care of the decay in the tooth, if there's not enough there to save, then again, you don't want to leave it in there. You want to go ahead and get the tooth taken out. And then you can preserve that space for an implant later. If you take a tooth out and you don't replace it immediately, like a tooth you said in the middle, not all the way in the back, but with a tooth on either side, if a tooth comes out, then something needs to go into that place within, you know, 6 months. Certainly wouldn't wait more than a year, because what's going to happen is things are going to start shifting, and the tooth below, if it's has nothing to occlude or touch against, it could start hyper erupting or moving upwards. The teeth on either side, when I said the tooth below, I was assuming an upper tooth, but the tooth in the opposite arch where the tooth is missing could start hyper-erupting. Also, the teeth on either side of the space can start moving.
So let's go to another question. We got the phone lines lit up. Thank you, Bob, for the call, and thank you for the answer. We're here with Dr. Hal Stewart. Art, welcome to Karen Conti Show on WGN. Your question?
Yeah, good evening. Before I get to my question, I do take the TheraBreath, which I think has that...
Xylitol?
Right.
Xylitol?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. So that's something good for that. My question is, does the my mother has like thyroid nodules. Does that affect anything as far as her teeth, to your knowledge?
Well, does she take thyroid medication?
No, it's not at that serious threat right now, yeah. It's not hyperthyroidism.
Hyperthyroidism. A lot of times people that are hyperthyroid also have a reduced salivary flow, and that can be very, very tough to manage it's called xerostomia. And especially in older people, if they have a chronic dry mouth, they're extremely susceptible to dental caries or decay. So I would have that checked out and go to a dentist that does manage older patients with the xerostomia. There are some good mouth rinses that are prescription mouth rinses that work for that. But if she has hyperthyroidism, the chances of her having xerostomia, dry mouth, are increased.
Thank you, Art. Thank you so much for the call. Let's go to Diane in McHenry. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi. What's your question for Dr. Stewart?
My six-year-old, she hasn't lost any teeth yet, and she has two bottom front teeth that are loose, and her permanent teeth are starting to break through behind them. And so I didn't know if I should take her to the dentist to have her baby teeth pulled, because I noticed she's starting to get a gap. Her teeth are starting to move around a little bit.
Thank you. Okay, Diane, thank you for the question. I'm going to put you on hold here and have the doctor answer. Go ahead.
Well, if she's six and her lower, you said that her lower two front teeth, at 6 years old, her permanent teeth should be coming in. Those little baby teeth can be taken out with no no negative consequences whatsoever.
Great. I've got a couple questions for you. I want to kind of get through these as quickly as possible. Teeth whitening. I hear a lot of people say it's bad for your teeth. That's why I don't do it. Is there something wrong with using the products, over-the-counter products, to whiten your teeth?
No, the over-the-counter products are fine. They usually, I mean, sometimes they work, but for the most part, they're not going to work as well as a prescription formula that you would get at your dentist. There's one in particular called Opalescence that there is a version of that I think you can get on the online on yourself, but it's not the same chemical formula as through the dentist. And it actually decreases decay, hardens the teeth, and makes the teeth less sensitive. So quite the opposite. Whitening can be very healthy for your teeth if the right chemical in the white whitening protocol is used.
Interesting. What about dental x-rays? I hear other people say, I don't like going to the dentist because I don't like getting x-rays. I just feel like it's not healthy to do that. Well, what's your take on that, doctor?
I understand that, but the standard of care is that patients have at least a set of bite wing x-rays once a year and a full mouth series or a panoramic x-ray once every 3 years. That is the minimum standard of care. So, you know, if your dentist is practicing that minimum standard of care, then they're going to request that from you. But there's over and over again, I see patients who come in regularly and have regular x-rays, and we can catch something at a very early stage, something that's caught at 6 months, if it waits until a year, can be devastating compared to catching it earlier. So I'm all for x-rays. The radiation effect is minimum. To have a full set of x-rays taken is about the same as taking a 30-minute walk outside in the sun. So you know, you're doing that once every 3 years. Bite wing x-rays are even half that much.
Let's talk about these do-it-yourself braces. I'm not going to name the name brands, but they're advertising all over where you, I don't know what you send in something, some sort of mold of your teeth, and you send it, and they send you back some do-it-yourself braces. Are those something that, I obviously, you're probably going to say you should go to a dentist and get it done correctly. As I always say, like with the legal stuff online, do your will on computer, I always say, why would you trust something as important as your assets and your family to a website? But
right.
Do they work, and what's the current state of how well they work?
Well, they obviously work on some people in the ideal case, and I guess it whatever you define work as, I guess that's the key here. They will move your teeth. Let me put it that way. They will move your teeth, but in many more cases than not, it's going to have a negative effect, and it's not. I'm vehemently against it. I think it's actually criminal, but somehow they're able to do it. But I would stay away from it if I were anyone out there. You don't trust your health to some doctor you've never seen before. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if they have doctors that look at the cases and the scans that come through. They say they do, but I've yet to see that.
You know, I see my friends who are going through the braces situation, and, you know, it's just so expensive for families, and it's such a horrible thing when kids don't get braces and they have crooked teeth, not only for purposes of cosmetics, but also function. I know I have 1 minute left, but what do you say to people about trying to afford braces? We just have a few seconds here.
Yeah, just do whatever you can to get the teeth straight, to get as much room in your mouth. Do not let the orthodontist extract teeth. That's the last thing you want to do. Too many kids suffer from airway problems as it is, and that's another topic for another day that we should discuss. But don't let the orthodontist extract teeth. Make your arches as wide as possible to give room for the tongue and have a good, healthy airway. That's even more important than having straight teeth.
Great. Dr. Hal Stewart, thank you so much for being a guest tonight. Where can people contact you if they need to?
I'm in north of Dallas in Flower Mound, Texas. My office number is 972-874-3957, and it's halstewart.com.
Thank you so much. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Stay tuned for the news. We talk about gender discrimination in the workplace and schools, you know, even in Hollywood, but is there gender discrimination in our world of medicine? It's one of the most important issues, don't you think? Women receive the same kind of medical care as men. Do we think so? Are the research, studies, and trials that develop medicine and treatment, are they inclusive of women so that women get a fair shake when it comes to that? If not, why not? And what do we need to do to fix it? Dr. Marla Mendelson is a cardiologist at the fabulous Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine and Northwestern Memorial Hospital. She's a board certified in internal medicine and cardiovascular disease, and she is the co-director of the Women's Health Research Institute, which studies gender bias, the very topic we're talking about. Dr. Mendelson, welcome.
Thank you.
You were here last year to the day. You just reminded
yes.
me. Oh my gosh, a whole year has gone by. And how serious is this issue, whether women get the same treatment in hospitals and doctors, by doctors and hospitals, as men?
This could be catastrophic. It could be life-threatening. We have been looking at this since 1990, when some studies first came out that said that women were being treated different from the men when they came into the emergency room with chest pain. And in cardiology, we've had Go Red, and we've had all sorts of informational campaigns and things like that. And we actually started to see some inroads. But cardiology is not alone. There are huge discrepancies in what we know about sex and gender differences in health and illness.
Is it just male doctors treating women differently, or are female doctors doing the same thing?
I don't know if we can indict male doctors on this. I don't know if it's that issue. I think we have a huge education and knowledge deficit that is feeding into this. We have studies that aren't done on women. They're not done on women. I think medications we use every day do not have to be studied in women to get approved by the FDA.
Let's talk about that in a minute. Let's just talk about going into a hospital. And I've heard these kinds of things, that women, when they complain about pain, are not taken as seriously. Is that, I know we're probably talking in big generalities here, and as a cardiologist, you obviously have different terms for these things. But is that true? Or is it just the symptoms that are being noted are different?
I think the symptoms and the manifestation of disease is different. And just to take a step back to what we're talking about, sex differences are biologic differences. And we see that all the time. They're due to a lot of different reasons. And we'll get into some of that later. And then gender differences is how you interact with society. So,
right, okay.
And perception. And women's symptoms, I know, again, I can speak from cardiology, but I think this is pervasive in many areas of medicine. Women's symptoms are not typical, like in the textbook. They're not as described in the textbook. They're a little bit different, but they still could be due to somebody having a heart attack.
Could you give an example what a typical male heart attack, and we probably know this, but how a woman might manifest the same type of problem, but in a very different way?
So on TV, you see somebody having a heart attack. First, they start rubbing their wrist, and then they grab their chest and they fall over. That's usually a man.
Yes.
A woman, it can be more subtle. And women may tend to minimize their symptoms. They may have a higher pain threshold. They may get not crushing chest pain. They may get nausea. They may get pain in their jaw, which could be still coming from their heart. There could be shortness of breath. There could be a lot of different things. All of those things we look at in men and women as a sign of a heart problem. But in women, those may be a little more common. I'm not convinced of all the research that's been done in it. But women who are at risk for heart disease, a good many of them are diabetics. And diabetics, whether you're a man or a woman, you don't get classic symptoms. So there's always multiple factors that come into play here. But yes, the people in the emergency room, for example, have to be aware of it, because now we're seeing younger women, premenopausal women, coming in with chest pain and having acute cardiac events, having heart attacks, because of a different mechanism that is more common in women. The artery kind of tears and sets up the same problem as with any other heart attack. We're starting to see that, and it really is incumbent upon emergency room providers to recognize this. And even if a woman you're looking at is 35 years old, she still could be having a heart attack.
Are you saying the research bears out that women are having worse outcomes to some extent than they should because of these problems? And it's hard to measure that, I would imagine, right?
Well, the American Heart Association is very good at compiling statistics every so often. And for a while there, in the new era of intervening in a heart attack immediately and saving heart muscle, the statistics were looking really great in men. The mortality after an acute event was going way down, and in women it was going up. We're starting to see that change. And the change started again with the Go Red campaign, with awareness, with making clinicians more aware, making women more aware. And I think that's what we really have been focusing on, at least we have at Northwestern, for, you know, 30 years, 25 years, to get women more aware that this could be happening, so they can advocate for themselves.
And is there, kind of skipping around here, but I know I'm thinking back to my mom, and she had some medical issues at the end, which many women do, many men too. But she would downplay her symptoms to the doctor, and she would kind of, I'm like, Mom, tell him how bad it was. Tell him how bad that pain was. And, oh, you know, I'm okay. It's all right. And what do you think? You know, and I think women maybe are a little bit more strong-minded these days, but some women are not. And even as a lawyer, I see women downplaying what's going on in their lives, and I have to ask 10 more questions to get it out of them in some cases. I don't know if that's something sociological, that we as women don't like to, you know, bother people with our problems, but is that part of this in some ways? I mean, I'm not blaming women. Believe me, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's how we're wired.
That's how we're getting to the gender bias. And there's gender bias within women themselves, and that's socialization, that I'm not supposed to complain. I'm supposed to take care of everybody else.
Right.
But, you know, we try to get the message out that you can't take care of everybody else if you're not healthy. And we have to sort of change that way of looking at things. One of the interesting things is getting women to exercise. And there are a lot of barriers to exercise, and it's really generational that you see. And so we're starting to improve on that front, where people are valuing exercise for multiple reasons. But in an older generation, it wasn't as common. Again, sweeping generalization, but it wasn't as common. And
are you saying that it's easier to get men of a certain age to exercise than women? Because I always think women are, you know, we like to look good, we like to keep our weight down, and like to wear our little size dresses or whatever, that would be something that would be easier to convince a woman of than a man.
Yeah. You'd be surprised. Also, I have a hard time in convincing people who are thin to exercise. So they may be thin, but they may not be fit.
Right.
And I think that's an important distinction. And that I see almost always in women. So there's a lot of eating disorder, dietary things and things like that with women. But I think overall in the general population, there at a certain age, there's less exercise, and it's just not being done. It's, you know, linked to vanity, again, a gender issue, but it's not pervasive enough to get people exercising.
Very interesting. We're talking to Dr. Marla Mendelson. She is the co-director of Northwestern's Women's Health Research Institute, which studies gender bias. And we're going to be talking to you some more about what you can do to make sure that you're taken care of and that some of these issues of discrimination do not impact your outcome. If you have any questions, give me a call here, 981-7200, or text to that same number, 312-981-7200. This is WGN, and I'm Karen Conti. We're here talking about gender discrimination in the world of medicine, and we're here with Dr. Marla Mendelson from Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, Northwestern Memorial Hospital. Dr. Mendelson, there was a text that had an interesting question. My sister died at age 41 from spontaneous coronary artery dissection. Is that the same thing as a heart attack?
Yes, that can cause a heart attack, and we just spoke about that in the earlier segment. That's the 35-year-old woman who comes in with chest pain and sweating and shortness of breath, and then they go into an EKG. Her EKG is abnormal. They check the blood enzymes, and her enzymes are abnormal, and all the things stack up that this is a heart attack. It is a different mechanism than what we see in those 65-year-old men or women, but it is an event, and it's an important event to recognize. And what happens is, we don't completely know why, and it happens in women, and it happens after pregnancy, that there's a tear in the artery wall, and it sets up the whole process, just like a heart attack, where the clot forms and stops blood flow.
Interesting. So it can present itself with the same symptoms, but the source is a different kind of issue.
But the end result is the same.
Yes.
So we have to.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the studies that are done in developing treatment and developing medicine. And I know your position is that women are not included in these studies. And therefore, some of the treatments are not geared toward women's issues when it comes to treatment for these kinds of things. Why is this happening? Why aren't women included in studies?
Well, this is a problem that's been going on for years. And starting from the cellular level and studies in animals, there were not female cells or female animals included in studies.
Why the heck not?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. They can be more expensive. The research is different because women have, or female animals, have pesky hormones which interfere with your results. And so they're saying it'd be easier to do it. Well, that has translated into clinical medicine. So in clinical medicine, and again, I can speak best to cardiology, but overall, the participation of women in studies where women do get the disease that's being studied is about 26%.
Wow.
Which is terrible. You're talking about diseases like heart failure, where it's 50-50 in the population, and yet only 25% of the study subjects are women. And there's been a lot of reasons. Sometimes if you're studying a drug, you put an age cutoff. And a lot of women with the disease may be beyond the age cutoff, so you don't have that information. They exclude women. They exclude women of childbearing age, whether that's appropriate or not. They're worried about the hormone cycle because things change over the course of a month for a woman. And that can affect the research. It can affect how the drug is metabolized. Or people are afraid that that's the issue.
So when companies do a study to say, you know, they want to cure diabetes, let's say, and let's just say that men and women have different issues when they have this disease, are you saying that should a drug manufacturer, say, have two different studies, one for men and women, or can it be the same study and you just have equal amounts, you know? How do you propose to remedy this situation?
Well, researchers should have more women in studies. Now, there are other reasons, too. Women are busy and they're, you know, they're
raising children,
taking care of their families, right, and their parents and everybody else. And so they may not participate. So actually at the Women's Health Research Institute, we started over 10 years ago a registry for the women in Illinois, all women over age 18, to register some basic health data anonymously into a database. Then researchers can come to our database and we can query the database for them to find women to participate in their studies. Women can decide to opt out at any point, but this is how we are physically getting more women into studies.
Why don't you give the information out? I assume that women are somewhat compensated for these kinds of studies, at least some of their expenses.
This one is very simple. It takes maybe 20 minutes. It can be done on your phone. It can be done on your iPad. It can be done on your computer. You go onto the registry and answer some questions. That's it. Now, if a person is chosen to participate in a study, there may be remuneration or parking and help to participate in that study. But our, you know, our registry does not require any tissue, any blood. We just want the information. And then we would give those names to researchers. They would contact women, and women could say, oh, I've changed my mind. I don't want to participate. That's perfectly fine. But this is a way we can get women into studies. A lot of the women in our registry may actually be controls, so that if you have a woman with diabetes who's 45, you really, to make your study strong, you want to know what happens in a woman who doesn't have diabetes. So that's what the registry is for.
And why don't you give out that information, and then I'm going to go to the phones. We have a caller for you.
That can be, you can get to the registry through our website, which is whr.northwestern, this is all lowercase, .edu.
Okay, one more time?
whr.northwestern.edu.
And you can always call me at the office or email me if you have my information, which I'll give out throughout the show. Let's go to Kim in Orland Park. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show. You're here with Karen Conti and Dr. Marla Mendelson.
Hi. You know, I have a hole in my left ventricle, and I get like every 3 or 4 years, and they usually do an echocardiogram. And when you're looking at the brain, you can see I can see where the blood leaks out. Is this something that, and they always say, you don't have to worry about the, but it's always in your mind. Is this something, what does your doctor suggest?
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Never closed and it was from birth.
Yes. It's called a ventricular septal defect, right?
Exactly.
Okay. My other hat besides the Women's Health Research Institute is I run our adult congenital heart program at Northwestern. So we see lots of people in your exact same situation. And the ventricular septal defect is unique. You were born with it. And it sometimes, in many people, it remains very uncomplicated through life. But it is important to touch base every so often because sometimes things change. And that's what they, and the best way to do that is with an echocardiogram, or certainly if you have any symptoms, you want to get to medical attention. Although people can live a very long life with this. If it remains uncomplicated, if it's uncomplicated, pregnancy is not an issue. But you need to, people need to know that you have it and that it needs to be checked every so often.
Thank you so much.
But why not? Wait, I had one more thing.
Sure.
Why wouldn't they just fix it? Why can't you go up through the groin and just plug it?
Well, you could. However, when every time we do a procedure, there's risk associated with it. And it would mean putting an artificial device into your heart, which becomes part of the heart muscle. And in that position, it may cause more problems than it solves, as far as future arrhythmias and things like that. So usually we do not fix these at this day and at this time. There are other types of holes in the heart that we do.
Kim, thank you so much. We're going to have to move on, but thank you for your call.
Fine.
It was very interesting. Thank you.
Yep.
So let's just talk briefly. The gender issue is one thing when it comes to discrimination, but I assume that race and age, and there are other factors of discrimination when it comes to being treated by a hospital or doctor. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. And this has been reported on numerous occasions. There are places in Chicago that are doing specific research in that. It is very hard to get research subjects that have diversity that we see in the population. Again, it has access to healthcare. There is sometimes a concern about being a research participant that it may infringe on their rights or it may be harmful. There's a lot of mythology out there about and concern and about research, and that people are not enrolling in research, so we don't have that information. The other thing is access to healthcare, period. And the big example of that is in this country, our maternal mortality numbers are appalling. And a lot of that has to do with underserved women who don't have good access to health care, and that's it's racial, it's ethnic, it's socioeconomic. There's a lot of different problems that come to bear, but it's still what the bottom line is that women are dying.
Dr. Marla Mendelson, thank you so much for joining us. If someone wants to contact you?
Through that website that I mentioned.
Why don't you give it again?
WHR.Northwestern, all lowercase, .edu.
Thank you so much for joining us. Stay tuned. We're going to be taking your legal questions here on WGN. This is The Karen Conti Show. This is the part of our show where I answer your legal questions, any questions you might have about any topic that affects you or that might be in the news. Let me give out the number, 312-981-7200, 981-7200. You could also text. And if for some reason you don't get through here or you'd like to speak more privately, I'm always happy to give you some answers or give you some referrals or maybe just some information if you call me at my office. My office number is 312-332-7800. And write this down because you don't always need a lawyer. I mean, you walk around all day and you never think about having a lawyer, but when you need one, you need one. And it's always good to have a reference. And if I don't handle the case, because I don't handle every kind of case, but at least I know people in the community who are good lawyers, who are reasonably priced, who might be in your area. and who might be suitable to represent you. And I'm always happy to give you that information. It's kind of a service that I do, and I feel like I'm doing good for the community, doing good for WGN, and I'm doing good for the people who need legal help and may otherwise find a lawyer who may not be the right person for you, because there's no real good source to find a lawyer, in my view. 312-332-7800. Let me also give you my email address. That is very helpful because you can give me a little bit of information, and I can usually email back pretty quickly what my answers are or what the referral is. And that email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, K-A-R-E-N-C-O-N-T-I. But now's the time to give us a call. Ben is standing by. I've had a couple of really interesting emails this week. I had an email, emailer from the Western Suburbs, who said the Supreme Court just heard a case this week about whether an employer can discriminate against a person because of sexual orientation. I thought that issue was already resolved. Why is the Supreme Court hearing that case? That's a really good question, and I think that might be something that people don't know. Generally speaking, about 20, 21 states and Guam, Puerto Rico, and Washington, D.C. have laws in place that specifically protect people because of discrimination due to their orientation, their sexual orientation, whether that's transgender, gay, whatever it is. So that is a state law that is in place, or a territory law that is in place, and the employers cannot do that without violating the law and without creating some civil liability. But the federal law doesn't really include gender discrimination based upon sexual identity. And so the question is, because it's not written right in the code, the 1964 law that we passed way back that opened up, restaurants and hotels to people of color, does that same law apply to protect you because of your identity, sexual identity? And interestingly, of course, it protects women, protects people of national origin and people with different religions, but does it extend to gender identity? And so that's the case that was up there. You know, you really don't know how the Supreme Court is going to rule. You listen to the arguments and you hear both sides of it. But in the end, they're going to write their opinion, and we'll see if the federal law actually encompasses gay people. You know, and so what happens if it doesn't? I guess they can try to amend the statute, the federal statute, to allow that kind of discrimination, disallow that kind of discrimination, make it actionable. But people in Illinois, for instance, it's the Illinois Human Rights Act that sets forth that as a protected class. And so we would be protected here in Illinois, but nationally it might make a difference to people in states that do not have that kind of protection. But that's a very, very good question. I also had an interesting question come in this week. And I don't know if you followed this, and this was the case down in Texas where the white female police officer accidentally went into the wrong apartment and she shot an African American guy who was sitting down eating a bowl of ice cream. A very tragic case, a horrible case. She testified that she didn't know and she was tired and went into the wrong place, thought someone was in her apartment and shot him. She was convicted and she is sentenced to 10 years in prison. And at the end of that sentencing, I don't know if you watched it on television, there was a very emotional moment where the brother of the deceased came over and hugged the defendant to show support and forgiveness, I guess. And it was a very touching moment. At that same time, or just after that, the judge came down and handed a Bible to the defendant. The defendant apparently asked the judge, you know, is God going to forgive me? And the judge said yes, and here's a Bible. I'm obviously making this story a lot shorter than it is. So the question is, and that people in my legal community and people online were saying, is this appropriate for a judge to come down and hug a defendant and give her a Bible? And, you know, is there something wrong with this whole picture? And again, you know, human contact and human instinct is good, and I like that. I guess I have a little bit of a criticism with the judge doing that, and here's why. judges are held to a very high standard, even higher than lawyers, and there can't be what we call an appearance of impropriety. So even if there's nothing wrong with doing something, if it looks like or could be perceived as being wrong or unethical or playing favorites, it's generally deemed to be not judicial conduct that we should be doing. So the question is, did she violate? Did she show some sort of lack of impartiality by hugging the defendant and giving her a Bible? And I guess if I were to answer that question, I'd probably say yes. And it just seems that, let's just say that there's post-trial motions, or let's just say there's an appeal and the case comes back to that judge. How does the public view the judge who hugged this woman, who gave her a Bible, who exchanged words with her? Does that show her impartiality, or does that show some sort of favoritism? I don't know. It just strikes me as something that probably should not have been done. I'm not saying the judge acted maliciously. She probably did it with wonderful intentions. She probably, her belief in religion and the Bible was overwhelming, and she wanted to help her. I like that. But I just think judges need to take the higher route and not show that kind of impartiality, because like I said, if the case ever gets back to her, and it might go up an appeal, might have post-trial motions, she might have to decide on this case, it would really kind of, I think, impact the way that people might view how justice is done. Again, she might be impartial, but the appearance of impropriety, I think, is significant. Give us a call here. The phone lines are wide open, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back for more of your legal question. Welcome back. I'm taking your legal questions. It's the Karen Conti Show, and this is the time, the last hour of my show from 8 to 9. I take your legal questions, get you on the phone. We listen to the facts. We listen to what your issues are, and I try to steer you in the right direction. 312-981-7200. The phone lines are wide open, and Ben has nothing to do, and he's getting paid no matter what. So he needs someone to talk to, and so do I. So give us a call here. If there's anything you saw in the news, any legal question that your friends have, it might be about divorce, it might be about credit card debt, it might be about contracts, small claims, traffic, criminal matters, I'll try my best to give you the answer or steer you in the right direction. And if you can't reach me, I'm going to give out my phone number at the office, 312-332-7800, or better yet, email me. It's a confidential email, so you can tell me your facts, and it's not going to be distributed to anybody except myself, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. A texter says, when can a lawyer be charged with a crime for actions of the client? That's kind of a big question, and I'm going to try to answer it as best I can. Generally speaking, if your client, I'm a lawyer, and so my client committed a crime, let's say, and I'm representing him in this in the matter. Well, obviously, I have nothing to do with the crime. I'm representing him, and I can do everything I can to zealously represent his interests. That's the word we use in law talk. So I can't put him on the stand if I know he's lying, because that would be suborning perjury. But I can argue that he didn't do the crime, and I can make the prosecution prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime was committed and that my client was the one who committed it. I think the question might be, though, what if you're advising a client on an ongoing basis? And what if your client is doing things that might be criminal? Well, clearly, you as a lawyer cannot perpetuate it. You cannot assist. You cannot conspire. You cannot help the client do something wrong. If you give the client advice that tells him he can do it, and the advice is legally sound, let's just say there's a room for difference on it, but you have a legal basis for saying, yes, you can deduct this on your taxes, or yes, you can take this action, then generally speaking, you're not helping the client commit a crime. You're just doing your job. And if you're wrong, that's a whole different thing. That's not really committing a crime. But if you're in there committing the crime with the client, if you're in there conspiring and making an agreement, knowing that this is a criminal act, then yes, you can be charged. And you do see these kinds of lawyers and sometimes accountants be charged because they might be cooking the books or maybe making misrepresentations to investors, or telling the client on how to avoid the laws or how to evade the laws or how to break the laws. And if the lawyer is doing that, then obviously there is a point where that person can be charged and convicted of a crime. But that's a very, very good question. We had a texter. I was talking about the case in Texas where the judge came off the bench and hugged the defendant and gave her a Bible. And this is in response to that from an 815 area code. The judge in Texas showed human kindness. We certainly could use more of that. I do not think a hug or a Bible was incorrect. The trial was over. The defendant could have evaded the hug and not taken the Bible if she wished. Thank you for that comment. And I think that's the way a lot of people think. I'm not even saying that the defendant resented. I think the defendant appreciated it. And I think she should appreciate it. The judge was kind and the judge was very warm and engaging and human. And I think that humanity is good. I'm just saying that the trial is over, but the trial could come back and the trial, it could be retried. It could come back on appeal. There could be post-trial motions. There could be motions about different things. And what I'm saying is because the judge did that, you know, detractors, the media, the prosecutors maybe could feel that she has compromised her integrity and compromised her impartiality by showing this kind of sympathy. And again, sympathy is good. Empathy is good. But when you're a judge, you have to sort of be beyond that and above that, just so you don't, you know, you don't have people think that justice is not being done. And, you know, I'm not going to liken this because I'm not taking a position on it, but the whole thing that happened with Kim Fox, our state's attorney, in the Jussie Smollett case, I'm not likening that at all, but there's something similar going on here, which is even if Kim Fox, the prosecutor, didn't do anything wrong, and I'm not saying she did, and my guess is that she didn't do anything wrong, but when the appearance looks strange, when you see something happen that you can't explain and you heard that there were phone calls made by important people to the prosecutor's office, even if Kim Fox never got the call, even if they weren't prosecuted, weren't given to her, and even though she didn't act on them, it still looks bad. And when we have a system like we have with the First Amendment, everything is very transparent, everything is very public. Now we have televisions in the courtroom. So if people see things that are odd, they're going to question the integrity of the system. And the integrity of the system has to be preserved. And I know I'm kind of waving a flag here, but that's why I'm saying it. I'm not saying that she didn't have a human right to do it and that it wasn't a good personal thing to do. I'm just saying that the system runs on impartiality, and in order to have confidence in it, I guess. I got a texter, and it was kind of a short text, and she was saying, I'm assuming it's a she. She said she wants to know about property rights, intellectual property rights. If I post it, does it belong to me? I'm not sure exactly what your question is, but my assumption is that if you write something and you post it, do you own the rights to it? Well, something you'd have to tell me more. You know, if it was a poem or something like that, and someone then took it, you could probably make the claim that they stole it from you and that you had intellectual property rights to it. But it gets very complicated because certain things are not copyrightable, and I don't know what you're talking about. If it's something that's able to be copyrighted, that is qualified for protection, by posting it, you could at least prove that you did it first, that you created it, and that if someone took it, arguably they are stealing your intellectual property. But there's a lot more to that question and a lot more to that answer that I probably would have to know in order to properly answer it. I had a call from a very nice WGN listener who I've heard from before this week, and she said that I have a personal injury case and it's taking a long time to process. I asked the attorney for a bill, and my lawyer says I'm not entitled to one and I don't give you a bill. Is that a problem? Is there something wrong with what the lawyer is doing? Well, generally speaking, if you have a case that your lawyer is billing you by the hour. So the typical case would be a divorce case or a business litigation case, you would get a bill probably every month, and your retainer agreement would say you're entitled to a bill, you're entitled to see what is being charged by the hour, who's billing the time, what are they doing, are they doing research, are they going to court, are they having settlement discussions, how long was the discussion, what are the expenses being incurred, what are the filing fees, what are the deposition costs, and you get a bill and you create that, and the client can look at it and see where the time is being billed and then pay the bill accordingly. Very important in a case like that. But when a case is on a contingency, when I say contingency, I mean a personal injury case is typically on a contingency, meaning you as a client do not pay anything unless and until there is a settlement or a verdict, and then you pay the lawyer one-third, usually, of the recovery plus the expenses that the lawyer incurred out of pocket. So traveling and postage and filing fees and maybe an expert witness fee to somebody who testified on your behalf, copying costs, things like that. So in your case, the caller was basically complaining because I want to see what my lawyer is doing, and the only way I can do that is a bill. Well, personal injury lawyers generally don't generate a bill, and you're probably not entitled to it. If you look at your agreement that you executed with the lawyer, it probably didn't promise a bill. You can, though, ask for a list of expenses that the lawyer incurred so that you know exactly what kind of expenses are being incurred, and that might give you some indication of where the lawyer is going. But certainly you should talk to the lawyer and communicate and say, listen, I haven't heard from you in 4 months. Where is my case going? What's happening? What are the negotiations? What are we settling it? Are we going to go to trial? What needs to be done? How long do you think it's going to take? What are the deadlines going on in the case? I see a lot of lawyers who aren't very good at communicating with their clients, which is really not a good thing. And that's the biggest complaint about lawyers, is they don't return phone calls and they don't communicate. And it's I understand when you have a very important issue that you don't, you know, you need to hear from your lawyer. So make sure your lawyer understands that you just need an update and you need it as soon as possible. Give us a call here. I'm still taking your legal questions, 312-981-7200. You're listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to The Karen Conti Show. I'm taking your legal questions here, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200, or text to that same number. Let's go to Augie in Chicago. Hi, Augie. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
I have a question about, can a homeowner demand a search warrant from a building inspector before letting him in the house to inspect the house? Solely based on an anonymous phone call and complaint.
Okay.
What is the homeowner's right?
Yeah, to? That's a very good question. And they absolutely either need your permission, and you can give them permission, or they need a warrant. They can observe from the sidewalk. They can observe what's going on. So if they hear noise or they see something that's inappropriate from the sidewalk, they certainly can do that. But to actually enter your home, they need a warrant, and you can make them go get that. Do you have a reason to believe? Do you know what they're complaining about or what the reason they want to come in?
No, but what some people call dropped a dime about my trees. So what had happened was that someone came on my property and cut my trees without my permission, and then the city picked up the refuse. But I'm beginning to think that they probably want. I have a nice house, although I'm on a.
Okay, well, hold on. One second. That doesn't make sense because you're saying that they want to come in your house. What do the trees have to do with being in the house?
Well, because I'm thinking that they're going to exploit it, the thing on the outside, and I'm concerned about maybe they want to get on the inside and want to know what my rights are.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm going to put you on hold here. You have a right not to let them in. They can go get a warrant if they want, if it's something that's very serious. Fire inspectors may be held to maybe a different standard, because if there's a fire hazard, they may have a right to come in without a warrant. But generally speaking, you have a right to refuse. If for renters out there who had that same question, the landlord is the one who can allow access. So you as a tenant do not have a right to have that search warrant issued, but if the landlord gives permission, then you have to let them in. So that's my answer to the question. Let us go. There was an interesting texter from 630. A reporter wrote an article about me that was 90% inaccurate, but caused me to lose my job. Can I sue her in a civil suit to force her to pull the article off of Google? Thank you. Actually, you can't. There's no real legal method to have someone remove something that's false. You can sue that person for defamation. In this case, it was written. So therefore, it would be called libel, which is a false fact, not an opinion, but a false fact, or in this case, article that was 90% inaccurate. Looks like there might be numerous facts that are false that cause you damage. And those would have to cause you lost businesses. You say you lost your job. And if that were related to these false statements, then you could hold them responsible for the losses attendant to your loss of a job. The question is, can you find a lawyer to bring a lawsuit for a reasonable price in order to get damages? And the answer is there's really no good way to do that. There are some lawyers who might take that on a contingency. And maybe if wrote an article, a reporter, if that reporter writes for a newspaper, for instance, maybe a lawyer would take that because the newspaper would be responsible for that reporter's false statements. But there's no mechanism to get that person to take it off. If you're interested, you can hire a lawyer to write a letter saying, this is false, this is false, you said this, that was false, you caused me damage, I'm going to sue you, take it off to minimize your damages, and maybe, hopefully, that person will be smart enough, if you're right about your situation, to take it off, and that might help you down the line. But there's really no good avenue to sue, because sometimes you have to pay a lawyer way more money than the whole thing might be worth. I have a 727 area code texter. One or the other of us gets called for jury duty every year, but we never get chosen to serve. How do lawyers choose their jury? We've read the Pelican Brief. Well, good. So that's everything you know about the law is in the Pelican Brief. You gotta love John Grisham, right? The jury. Yeah. You know, jurors, there's a whole art form to picking a jury, and it depends what kind of case you have. If you're a plaintiff in a personal injury case, you're going to want people who are willing to give money to injured people. You might want people who have been injured in the past. You might want people who, you might not want an accountant who's conservative with money. You might not want a business owner who's been sued in the past who might not like to give money to someone who's injured. So it depends on the case. Again, criminal defendants. There's a whole litany of just all this research done on who is best for criminal defendants, based upon race, based upon the crime, based upon the area. And there are jury consultants that spend their whole lives studying people and where they live and how might they answer questions, and are they really telling the truth about how impartial they would be? So the answer to your question is, that's a big question. How do people pick jurors? They want someone who's going to be fair to their case. They want someone who's going to be favorable to their client. And when both parties do the same thing, you hope in the end that an impartial juror is going to be picked. So it could be that maybe you and your husband, or you and whoever you live with, who you're referring to, are people that have very specific opinions. And if people have very specific opinions and have prejudices and answer questions like, no, I never would give money for a personal injury because I don't believe people get personally injured. Or you might say, I think criminal defendants get a raw deal and I would always disbelieve a prosecutor and a police officer. You're not going to be put on the jury. In fact, the judge might say that there's cause to keep you off the jury. So, you know, you never know why you're not picked for a jury. You really don't know unless you ask the lawyers. And mostly when you're dismissed, you're not going to hang around to ask that question. But it's a good one. It's a good one. Let's go to Randy in Hillside. Hi, Randy. Welcome to the show. What's your legal question?
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good.
Anyway, my question is, okay, me and my neighbor, we have a restraining order against one another. Back in July, I was mowing my grass, and he says that my lawnmower went across the line, and I violated a restraining order. Such nonsense. Anyway, I got an attorney. He cost me money, days off to go to court. We're waiting for a video to be produced. I didn't do anything wrong other than mow my grass. If it comes out that everything is fine, which it should, could I sue him for all the aggravation and my attorney fees? And
so let me ask you this question. So who got the restraining order first, you or the neighbor?
My neighbor confronted me with a rifle on property line.
Okay.
All right. He beat me down to get the restraining order. On what grounds he got his, I have no clue.
Okay, wait, I just want to make sure. There is a restraining order against you that says that you cannot go on his property, right?
Yes.
Okay, and so you're mowing the lawn. He claims that you violated that order of protection by going onto his property, right?
Yeah, with the hand mower went across the property line.
Is that case set for a hearing?
Yes.
Okay, and you're going to get a lawyer and you're going to defend that, correct?
I got a lawyer, yes.
Okay.
I gave him a retainer fee.
Okay, so good. So you're going to fight that. You're going to hopefully get a video. You're going to hopefully prove that this is false.
Well, yeah. I mean, they supposedly got a video. The first one that came in was blank. Made a DVD, and it was blank.
Okay.
So now we're waiting for a new one. This happened in July.
Okay.
July 7th, actually.
All right, and I'm sorry, I'm running out of time, but the answer to your question is if they lose the order of protection and the order of protection is not violated, you generally don't have a right, unless the judge finds it to be frivolous, that he frivolously brought this case with no facts at all, and then you might have a right to get your attorney's fees paid. But if he loses, that doesn't mean that you win all of your fees, and unfortunately, that's the way those kinds of things work. It sounds like you've got a bad situation with that neighbor. I feel bad for you, because neighborhood disputes are the absolute positive worst. And so hopefully you'll win that and you'll be able to prove that and he'll back down. Let's continue to take your calls into the last segment, 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. This is Karen Conti. You still have some time left to get your legal calls in, 312-981-7200. I have an 847 texter who says, my friend who is disabled and walks with canes has worked for the same employer full-time for 23 years. She had a lawsuit regarding her disability, and at the employer's request, she became a part-time employee. The results in the case, she received a $6,000 payment. Now part-time employee and has a mandatory retirement in 8 months. She and the employer signed a document. Does she have any recourse at this time? She is an excellent employee with good evaluations and does her job well. You know, from what you told me, Texter, it sounds like she brought some sort of suit or she brought some sort of claim, maybe in the EEOC. And as a result of that, there was a compromise reached. And I'm reading between the lines here that she continued to keep her job. She went to a part-time employee. She got paid $6,000. And there was a portion of that agreement that said that she had to retire at a certain age. If that's all in writing and that whole settlement was premised on all of those terms that you set forth here, then she doesn't have any recourse because the deal is done. Once you make a deal, once you make a settlement, once you accept the money, once you sign the papers, that is a done deal and there's not going to be any legal recourse. So that's my best answer to that question, given the facts that you gave me. That's a very interesting situation. Another texter from 269 says, my ex didn't pay child support for 15 years. I didn't go after him because he was abusive. That's a very common thing that happens. A lot of people, you know, I'll say men and women, but, you know, women will not want to take the guy back to court because there's bad blood and you don't want to deal with that anymore and you don't want to involve the children in it. And so you just don't go after your child support. Her question is, can the children who are now adults file for back support, or is there a statute of limitations? And the answer is that in Illinois, children cannot go for back child support. The right to sue is yours and yours alone. So the children will not get involved in that, and they can't get involved in that. But you can. And if it's a significant amount of money, my guess is that you've had a child support order in place, 15 years has gone by. The interest rate is 9% per annum. So that's a huge interest rate. So that every time he didn't pay the support, that 9% would start to accrue on that amount. And my guess is if you look at what's owed and you do the calculation on it, it's a huge amount of money. So you can take him back to court. There is no statute of limitations. It was a judgment. He didn't honor it. I have had cases where I go back 10, 12 years. 15 years is a long time, but you can still do it. And the courts will probably make him pay it back. The question is, does he have a job and does he have assets? Because if he's not working and he has no assets, you might take him back to court, go through all the trauma and the expense of hiring a lawyer to do it, and then not get anything in the end. So that's something that you and a potential lawyer would have to kind of map out to see if it would be worth it to take that action, go back to court, and try to get some of your money. And again, you know, the judge can throw the guy in jail if he doesn't have the money to do it. And when judges get ready to throw people in jail, people take their shoeboxes out from under the bed. They find their great aunt who has money, and sometimes you get paid. Actually, I was in Lake County Court a couple weeks ago, and I sat there and I watched three guys get put in jail. One was lying about child support, not being able to pay it when he had a job. You know, one was not paying support, and the judge deemed him to be willful in so doing, and took them into custody right there in the courtroom. They had to take off their shirts. They have to put their handcuffs on. They had to give up their cell phones and take off their shoes and belts. And they were immediately taken into custody on a Friday, which meant that they were probably going to be there the entire weekend. So again, for women out there, or for men out there who are owed support, you know, you have a right to get it. For men and women who might owe support, don't mess with it, because when that amount gets so great, you might get to a point where you can never pay it off, and you might face the issue of actually being held in contempt. Let's go to Mark in Vernon Hills. Hi, Mark. Welcome to WGN.
Oh, hello, Ms. Conti.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. My mother is in need of some, for medical services to get into, like, assisted living. And so I'm meeting with an elder care attorney who has got that certification.
Okay.
It's a first time meeting, though, so I'm wondering, I guess there's a half an hour preliminary discussion where I can talk to the lawyer and figure out, like, exactly what they could do. And I'm really kind of looking at medical annuities to kind of protect her assets in some way that can help her live out the duration of what she needs in assisted living. So after the half an hour, though, I'm kind of wondering what to expect. After that, they are about over $400 an hour after that. So I'm kind of wondering, after the half an hour and I kind of get to discuss my issue, what's the typical...
So Mark, so this is very particular to the lawyers, because some lawyers do free consultations, some lawyers charge for the consultation, and you should never make a decision based upon having to pay for a consultation. That's the way some lawyers work. Are you saying that first half an hour is free, and thereafter that lawyer will start to bill you for his or her time?
That's what I was told by their assistant.
Okay.
First half an hour, yeah.
Okay, so here's what you should do, Mark. You should get that in writing, and you don't have to be a pain about it. Just say, I just want to make sure I know what's going on. I want to know what my obligations will be. And if you can just put in writing, the first half hour is free, thereafter it's $400 an hour. And here's what you might do, Mark. Here's what you might ask her questions in a half an hour period. Have the lawyer say, here's what I would do. I'd put together a trust. I would get the person involved with an investment advisor. I'd get, whatever those recommendations are. And then you might say, all right, I'm going to stop this meeting now. I want to think about it. I want to consult with some people, and then I will come back and hire you one way or the other, or not hire you. So that maybe you have some time, because if you get all that information, you may not know what to do from there on. And that could get to be a very expensive proposition that you're making. Now I want a will, and maybe now I need a trust, and maybe now I need you to put me into this type of thing. So it might make sense to just try to get that free consultation first and say, let me think about it, because there may be some other professionals that may... I'm going to put you on hold just because there's some noise here.
Sure,
and so you,
sure.
But you'll continue to listen. Okay. This kind of elder law care, it's great that person has a certification in that, or claims to have a certification in that. You might want to look into exactly what that is. But it kind of crosses over a lot of different things. There's Social Security issues. There might be wills and estate planning issues. There might be tax issues. There may be financial issues. If you're talking about annuities, this may be something maybe outside the lawyer's purview. Maybe this is something a financial advisor would need to get involved in. I don't know, and I don't know this person's qualifications. This person could be a CPA and a lawyer. But I would say that instead of rushing into a lengthy legal consultation that might cost you $1,000, that you take a break and take that information, take good notes, and then come back if you want to pursue that line of plan that the lawyer has. That might be a good way to handle it. You can also, Mark, if you want to email me and I can tell you if I've heard of this person and what I think of the person's qualifications, given the website, if I don't know the person, because sometimes I can see things, I might have some suggestions for you. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. I get a lot of those kinds of questions. I don't badmouth other lawyers, but sometimes I might have suggestions for people that I know who at least I have experience with, or I might say that person is super qualified, you're in the right hands, or I might say you need someone with maybe a little bit more experience in this XYZ area. Let's go to Ahmad in Chicago. Hi, Ahmad. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay.
We're going to make this really fast. Oh, my gosh. I've got like 2 seconds here.
All right. So I got a judicial sale property and unpaid assessments from the previous owner. Condo board gives conflicting amounts of the unpaid assessment, and they are denying access to books and records.
Okay, that's really ridiculous. I'm going to put you on hold too, just because I want to give this. So you're entitled to see that if they're claiming that you owe money. Actually, you don't owe money, the prior people, but you have to take care of it in order to get access. You need to have that in the bylaws. You should get the bylaws. Make sure you have them. The bylaws should tell you exactly what you're entitled to when it comes to this. If they're making a claim that you owe money, they better be able to prove it. And you might have to hire a lawyer to write a letter to that effect. Hopefully that'll help you out. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. I can probably give you someone to do that. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, everyone. Stay tuned for Rick Hogan, and happy Columbus Day to everybody. You are listening to The Karen Conti Show on WGN. Stay tuned for the news.